On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, the 2024 MLB draft is shaping up to be absolutely stacked. Weatherholt, Bezzana, Burns, Kurtz, everyone else also good. Marlins Giants was interesting. Rafi Devers threw a bit of a temper tantrum. The Tigers are alive with the sound of music. And Bryce Harper hit for the cycle. All that and a whole lot more on a delightfully energetic episode of Baseball Barbacast. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world. Overjoyed that Bryce Harper is cycling something other than his own blood back into his own body. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And can you hit a triple without raw milk?
Well, at the very least, Googling Bryce Harper cycle is a little bit safer now than it was before his epic performance over the weekend. We are going to get to Bryce Harper's big weekend, somehow outshining Kyle Schwarber, homering every time he steps to the plate. Much Phillies discussion to come later on in this episode of Baseball Barbacast. But on this Monday, we're going to do something a little bit different because the kids are playing some good ball. And so our first topic today is a little bit of redraft, and let's do it. It's our opener.
Not even 2 years have passed since the 2024 draft. In baseball years, that's not a lot of time. Typically, players require more than two full seasons to become the people, the players that they will eventually become. Development does not happen in 24 months. But for whatever reason, maybe we can get into the reasons behind it, the 2024 MLB draft is already shaping up to be one of the greatest of all time. Question mark, exclamation point. The amount of talent that we have seen from this class is startling. So what we're going to do on this episode is redraft. We're going to go back and forth and talk about some of these players, and hopefully you will get a sense for how we value them, not even 2 years after the day they were drafted.
Yeah, and I want to reframe it slightly because saying that this is an all-time draft, we're far too early to do that. So I think to me, the reason we're going to do this is, I mean, it's timely in that a lot of the players drafted in the top 10 are playing really, really, really good ball right now, including over the weekend. J.J. Weatherholt, two-homer game. Cags homered in all three games against the Royals, or against the Cardinals, I should say. Travis Bezzana had a 4-for-4 game with two homers. Nick Kurtz continues to rake. Chase Burns looks like one of the best pitchers in baseball. It's so early in all these guys' career, it's going to be impossible to judge where this stacks up historically. But what's so fun about this is really the first point you made, is how quickly we are having this conversation, how fast these players have gotten to the big leagues and given us an idea of who they can be as big leaguers, where they are going, and actually giving us something to think about, because this was already a fun debate on draft day. And it hasn't really gotten any easier, but it's also gone in some unexpected directions, yeah, as well as given us some candidates even beyond the stacked top 10 that are also going to, yeah, factor into this conversation.
I do think that the speed with which these players have gone from draft day to producing at the big league level is indicative of a shift within our game. Some of that is credit to college development and how advanced some of these top programs are. Some of that is a credit to, in the case of the high schoolers, the proliferation of elite private coaching. In the case of Connor Griffin, who had access to coaching that, you know, was not that different from what big leaguers are going to get in the offseason. I think that has kind of shrunk the timeline here for a lot of guys and is a sign moving forward that I think this is a trend. Like, I do think we will see guys go from draft day to contributing in the big leagues quicker than they have in previous seasons. And I think that's a good thing for people like you and I that really care about the draft. I think 10 years ago, it was more difficult to get a casual fan interested because you'd be like, hey, trust me, one day this guy will be good. Now, yes, you had your outliers, you had your Strasburgs and your Harpers. But even for a player like Carlos Correa, right? like it was not immediate to go from number one overall pick in 2012 to debuting in 2015. That we're looking at something different here.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And there are other factors pushing players through the minor leagues faster, as we've sort of alluded to. But yeah, I think that this group in particular, especially with how college heavy it was and how accomplished this group was, I continually referred to it, but I can't stress it enough. The careers that these players had in college, statistically, 2-3 years of just incredible production, it was amazing that there were this many of them in the same draft. Now, albeit from different programs, at different positions, and some very different trajectories. So it makes all of it very fun. And so, yeah, so what we're going to do for this opener is a redraft. We'll review at least the top 10 picks here, maybe top 15, to just remind people who did go in what slot. And then we're going to do our best to say, we'll take turns and say how we would redraft it if we were going to redo it today. So as you mentioned, we are big fans of the draft. It's something I spend a lot of time on really year round. I'm heading down to the draft combine tonight. So a lot of these kinds of conversations and what we think, this is useful for me too, because I'm thinking back to when I did my rankings, you know, 2 years ago, and what did I miss? Who was I right on? Who was I wrong on? What led me in those directions and led me to those conclusions? And also, because I had spent a lot of time thinking about it at the time, maybe more than you, how much have I changed my mind versus sticking to what I kind of went with 2 years ago? So let's remind folks what actually happened. So you want to review at least the top 10 to 15 picks? Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. I'm going to do 20 just because I think that's the cutoff for big league relevance. Travis Bezzana, Guardians. Chase Burns, Reds. Charlie Condon, Rockies. Nick Kurtz, Oakland A's, was Oakland at the time. Hagen Smith, Chicago White Sox. Jack Caglione, Royals. J.J. Weatherholt, Cardinals. Christian Moore, Angels. Connor Griffin, Pirates. Sievert King, Washington Nationals. Bryce Rayner, Detroit Tigers. Brandon Montgomery, Red Sox. James Tibbs, Giants. Cam Smith, Cubs. Gerangelo Saintgeau, Mariners. P.J. Morlando, Marlins. Braylon Payne, Brewers. Theo Gillen, Rays. Carson Benj to the Mets. Trey Savage to the Toronto Blue Jays. Jordan, because you are more invested in the draft, you have done more, you've done the work more than I, and therefore you get the first pick.
Thank you. So I will probably refer to my rankings here along the way, just to remind myself, like, okay, where was I at? And I think I just mentioned we were going to be the ones where I have to come on here and be like, wow, I screwed that one up. And I think that's a good place to start, because if there was a huge whiff that I had that year, it was Mr. Nick Kurtz, who I will select first in this draft. I had him 10th. I had him down, as opposed to with some of these other superstar college players who maybe played more valuable positions, who seemed to show more upside. I had him down grouped with James Tibbs, because I saw two left-handed bats who had prolific production, who I was like, okay, let's see. He had some health question marks. He had never done it with wood bats in the summer. And so I was like, okay, I understand Nick Kurtz. It looks great, but I'm just not fully buying it. And I mean, listen, maybe this is a hot take to take him first because he is still a first baseman and still has dealt with some question marks, but the offensive upside is unbelievable. And maybe we're being fooled a little bit because he's gotten to hit a lot in Sacramento and even Vegas for a week. But I just think that his slugging potential, what he showed last year as a rookie, is just too overwhelming and enough of an offensive upside above the rest of these players that I think I would take him first if I could redraft it.
Very reasonable pick. I think there are three legitimate ways to go at number one, which means that with your third pick, I think you will get the last of that trio. But at number two, I'm going to go with J.J. Weatherholt of the St. Louis Cardinals, who you had, I believe, ranked at number one entering the draft.
No, number three. I had Bezzana and then Condon too, which I obviously regret. But I had Weatherholt at three, and he obviously went seventh.
He goes seventh. So the reason I'm taking Weatherholt over Connor Griffin, who I would guess you'll take next, is that Weatherholt has performed offensively while contributing a preposterously high defensive value. He is, by OAA, outs above average, the second most valuable defender in the sport behind only Pete Crow Armstrong. And that is with him playing second base. He hit his 12th home run. He's up to 12 home runs, had a number of homers over the weekend, and has been a big part of the Cardinals' resurgence this season. I think he offers, like, when we talk about players that can, that are like difference makers beyond the field and how they carry themselves, it's really difficult to do that as like a rookie, right? But I can see a world in which in 3 or 4 years, we're talking about JJ Weatherholt as a Kyle Schwarber, Alex Bregman clubhouse difference maker. And for me, the floor of the profile and the off-field stuff, not to say that like Connor Griffin is an asshole. He is not, very much not a bad guy or a bad kid. I'm saying that Weatherholt has a chance to be special and, like, for all of the cliche this carries, a winning player. And I'm rolling my eyes at myself as I say that. That's why I'm taking him over Griffin with the second pick. Now, this could end up looking really stupid because Connor Griffin could just, you know, be Bobby Witt Jr. But right now, I'm going to take the floor.
Yeah, and what you just referenced there about JJ's impact, first of all, defensively, is just mind-blowing. Now, he, and we talked to him about this at the Combine, his confidence about his ability to play shortstop. And I do think on a lot of teams that didn't have Mason Winn, he would be playing shortstop. But the fact that it's translated immediately to outlier defense at second, and yeah, by fielding run value, he is a, just a touch above Bobby Witt Jr., which is amazing. I mean, I would still consider Bobby Witt Jr. the more impactful defender because he is playing shortstop, and PCA is in a world of his own. But the fact that he's already up in that conversation is amazing. And to your point about his off-the-field impact, talking to people who know, it's already happening. He's already, he has already brought a level of confidence and comfort. And yeah, I'm here to win. I know I'm this rookie and I'm part of this next young wave. Like, why not? Why can't we just, now he can't do it all on his own for a lot of reasons, but it's not an accident that the Cardinals are hanging around and JJ Weatherholt being a huge part of that. So it was going to be really hard for me to decide between him and Griffin. So I'm glad you gave me the first pick because it was kind of easy to pick Kurtz.
Yeah. But yeah, I will be honest with you. If I had the first pick, I think I would still take Weatherholt.
Okay. Yeah.
You would have taken Kurtz over Griffin, obviously, because you just took Kurtz.
I would. But let's just go to Griffin here so we can keep it moving. I think you just alluded to it. I think that while he has still shown the least in the big leagues, he's not hit that much in the majors right now. He's injured. He's working his way back from an arm injury that was preventing him from playing shortstop. He still has the best upside of any of these players, and it's not even really close. And that was true on draft day, right? But the fact that he has actualized it already is incredible, that he got to the big leagues this quickly, that he's also playing a damn good shortstop and making a huge difference on the bases. The bat's going to take some time, but over the long haul, you can still make an argument he should go first based on what he's shown you and based on obviously what the Pirates have exhibited that they believe in him. So it could still take a while. And so you'd love to just bank the production that you're getting from a Kurtz, that you're getting from Weatherholt, that you're getting from a Burns, Bizzano, who we're about to talk about. But as far as upside, Griffin is still the answer. And just because it's been a little bit of a slow start offensively, let's not lose sight of what this guy could really be when it all comes together. So the Bobby Witt Jr. comp is impossible to ignore when you consider how relatively slow his career started offensively and what he looks like now. So I'll happily take Griffin at 3 here.
I'm going to go with Travis Bizzano. I have been so impressed because he has showed up and has kind of done exactly what we thought he could do. A lot of damage. OPS is 838. Now, I'm a little bit concerned about the defensive numbers. It's super small sample size. But if you're looking for the combination of ceiling and floor, I'm going to go with him over Burns just because pitchers scare me.
Yeah, and it's that simple. I also would do this order because, I mean, I had Bizana number one. I don't regret that because I do think that the floor that he was exhibiting at the time and has now already started to show very quickly, his aptitude, how much he's gotten better every year since he was 16, continuing to adjust to every level, the way that he thinks about the game, his work ethic, his determination, his player development mindset is so incredible. I think if there was a mistake in putting him over Weatherholt, it was the overall defensive upside. Weatherholt also had some medical questions on draft day and he didn't play as much as junior year that impacted his draft stock. But Bizana, I think that was the mistake, is that even if he develops into an okay second baseman, that is, when you consider the offensive upside is probably comparable with Weatherholt, that's probably not as much of overall value compared to what JJ is showing you. That said, I don't regret having Bizana first. I obviously was validated because the Guardians took him first, but I think that taking him over the pitchers who we're about to talk about is totally valid.
Your move.
Yeah, I mean, Chase Burns, like, he had another great start over the weekend. And this is another important point to make here as we look back on this draft. This was a surprise when he went second. And not because he didn't have an amazing season and wasn't a top prospect, but it was kind of, maybe this is us not learning, right? Because on one hand, what we're doing right now, which is take all the hitters before Chase Burns, is what we thought the teams would do on draft day. And yet, it's hard to complain about what he's done so far. And the fact that he's dominating to this degree with basically two pitches is so impressive.
Yes, is unbelievable.
And so, I don't know what more you could have asked him to do. And it feels kind of absurd that he's falling in this redraft when he's outperformed what I thought he was going to do.
The Reds should be overjoyed with how this pick turned out.
Would you rather have Nick Kurtz? Yes. Is this a bad pick? No, it's not.
No. Absolutely not. And it is just the way I feel about pitchers. And that is a sad reality, that at any time, any pitch, the whole thing could go kablooey. Chase Burns, because we have him here at six, it's going to sound like we're putting him down, which is not fair. But because he's only doing it with two pitches, you can look at that in two different directions, right? On one hand, you could say, well, if he ever loses a little bit of fastball velocity, the whole Jenga block tower is going to come tumbling down. But on the flip side, it's like, well, with this arm speed and the aptitude, he could probably learn a couple more pitches at some point and get even better. Pitchers scare me.
Yeah. And I also think that, we always say it so flippantly, oh, they could get hurt anytime. That's true. It doesn't mean their career's over, as we've now seen many times. Sometimes it's just an interruption as opposed to a complete derailment and you never come back from it. But I do think that it's something to consider. But I'm still so impressed with him. I think I've made this point about him before. It is amazing that they now just have another pitcher that's dominating with two pitches the way that Hunter Green has been doing for so long. And he's like, oh, well, he just has to get another pitch. It's like, not really. If you're throwing this hard and your slider's this good, you can kind of just keep going. So he's also in a weird spot with this because obviously a lot of these players are rookie eligible. Chase Burns did exhaust his rookie eligibility last year. So we're not going to be like him versus Weatherholt for rookie of the year potentially could have ended up being a really interesting conversation. Unfortunately, now he is relegated to the Cy Young conversation, which, as we've mentioned many times, is a historic group of pitchers. And so now that said, if he stays healthy and keeps pitching like this, I mean, he'll be right in there in that top group with Mizrowski and Sanchez and Skeens and Ohtani. I mean, I don't see why not. He has been that good through half a season. So, yeah, Chase Burns, he's legit. So now I'm really curious where you go from here because there are some pitchers on the board that you certainly could argue, but there's also a hitter who's looking a lot better than he did last season.
Yeah, I heavily considered taking Carson Benj over Bizana. And now as I'm looking at Carson Benj's Baseball Savant page, I am rethinking that in the moment, but that doesn't really matter because I'm taking him here. I'm taking Carson Benj. I have been so impressed with his, I mean, he was over the first month, like, legitimately bad. Like, he was really terrible. Mets moved him up to the leadoff spot in early May, and since then he has been one of their best hitters. A, you know, little bright spot for a team that has been one of the worst offensive clubs in the sport. He doesn't really ever walk. His bat to ball is so good. His ability to find the barrel, his ability to get the ball in the air at optimal angles. I think this kid is just like, he knows how to hit and doesn't know how to explain it. He's been better defensively than I expected, and I think is just going to be the leadoff guy for the Mets for the next 5 years.
So Bench, who, as we mentioned, went 19th, would certainly go higher than 19th. However, give me Cags here. I'm going to take Cags next. Jack Caglione, who's been as an OPS over 1,000 in June. And frankly, if we're talking upside and also downside, because the profile here is he's still striking out a lot. He's still chasing a lot, as he always has. And he's honestly whiffing more than you would maybe hope, considering one of the strangest things about evaluating Cags in college is that he was chasing so much, but also not striking out. Facing better competition in the big leagues is now you're seeing that exposed more. That said, I mean, maybe the peaks and valleys are a little bit more turbulent and a little, and last year was a troubling beginning to his career too. But the upside here, the dude could hit 40 home runs in a season and they just moved the fences in. Screw it. 50 home runs in a season. He's showing us what he can be. And while maybe he's not playing a little bit of center field, like maybe Benj could, maybe he's not as much of an impact defender or plus defender, whatever. And yes, he's going lower than he did on draft day. I think in some ways where he went is he probably should have gone fifth, at least when you consider the context. We'll get to Charlie Condon in a second in terms of just where he fits into this. But I'm happy to get to Cags here. That's true. You might take Charlie Condon. I'm happy to take Cags here. And now I was deciding between Cags and another pitcher, but. Interesting that you're going with Benj, and I understand that. I don't know if Benj would have been in my top 10 quietly, but I get it. So let's send it back to you. There's certainly another huge Benj. name left. Well, I don't think I'm low. Like I said, he'd certainly go way ahead of 19. I don't know. I'm the bat to ball is there. The approach is there. I don't know. I'm waiting to see how much juice there is. Maybe it's unfair to him because in my head right now, I'm comparing him to someone with ludicrous juice, like Jack Caglione, and not to just like the average outfielder. So am I low on Benj? I guess I am, but it's certainly for the purposes of this exercise, I haven't seen quite as much. Like, okay, it's very simple. I've seen more of a Cags in the last month than I've seen from Benj at all in the majors. So in that sense, and I get we're that. Talking small samples, maybe that's unfair, but yeah.
Yeah. I think as Benj grows into more strength, like he's a pretty wiry, lean kid.
Yeah,
I think he just, as he matures in his 20s, is going to get stronger. And, you know, what do they say about Machado? The doubles will turn into homers. I think something similar happens with Carson Benj. Okay, I am deciding between a hitter and a pitcher. I'm just going to play it safe. I'll take Trey Savage.
Okay.
Pitchers do scare me. The guy that has already dominated in the World Series. Like...
Yeah.
Baseball history is indeed littered with pitchers that were very good in the playoffs at a young age and not didn't necessarily sustain that over a full season or over a full career. Yeah. I think Trey Savage is talented enough and has enough of a shtick, that being his splitter and weird release angle, that he is going to be good enough, maybe not great enough to like be, I wouldn't take him number one or number two, whatever, which I think the city of Toronto and the nation of Canada would have last October. I think that there is a nice floor here for Trey Savage. And so I think he's clearly the second best pitcher. Curious if you would have taken any other arms over him.
I don't think I would have, but I am going to take Peyton Tolley next. just a huge Peyton Tolley fan. The last thing I'll just say about you, Savage, and I referred to this multiple times throughout the postseason, but for those wondering, medical concerns were pretty much the whole reason he fell to 20 in the first place. And I'm sure there are people that listen to this and are annoyed by how vague that is, but when you're talking medical stuff at the draft, it's kind of, you kind of just have to be a little bit more vague than be direct, because some rumors are more, you know, unsubstantiated than others. But in his case, it's just a fact. I mean, on True Talent, I think I had him ranked 11th, maybe 12th. Just reviewing. Yeah, I had him 12th. So, and even once he got past that range on draft day, it was like, okay, clearly there are some concerns here. He had a weird freak situation with a punctured lung during his junior year, but there was also some other stuff throughout his college career that gave some teams pause. And frankly, I mean, he obviously then started this year on the injured list with some stuff that was a little bit concerning. He's back now and looks very good. So I agree with you. I think I would have taken him next, but he, even more than a Burns, and even more is just like, okay, well, usually the pitchers that have already been hurt are going to keep getting hurt. I'm going to take Peyton Tolley here, though. Peyton Tolley was one of my favorite draft rankings that I've done in the years since I've been doing this, because I put him at 50. It was an aggressive ranking at the time, and he literally went exactly 50th. So that was very validating. He's since performed and zoomed to the big leagues way faster than I ever could have hoped. And for all the terrible things the Red Sox have done as an organization over the last few years, they have done some things very well, and that is identify some pitchers with some outlier traits and get the most out of them. And this is a guy who is a two-way player in much of his college career that has really made the most of some elite traits, most notably his elite extension from the left side. Velo's ticked up. He's also just one of my favorite humans in the sport. You will not leave a conversation with Peyton Tolley without smiling. And so I'm a little biased there too, but I think he's a great pitcher. I think he's, and I really would consider taking him over Yusavage if we're talking about projectability, roundup, what he has accomplished, what he could still accomplish. So there are some other interesting hitters on the board here that we can talk about. But and now I'm really curious who you go with for this 10th and final pick of this redraft before we kind of rapid fire some other names.
Sure.
But yeah, I'll go with Tolley here.
I'm caught between two Chicago White Sox. I am caught between Sam Antonacci and Caleb Bonnemer.
Okay.
Are you laughing? Right, why are you laughing at me for?
Wow.
What are you laughing at?
So hold on. So hold on. Not Braden Montgomery. You're not considering Braden Montgomery.
No.
Who was not drafted by Sam the White Antonacci, Sox, but is now on the White Sox.
Sure. Sam Antonacci and Caleb Bonnemer.
Sorry. Hello. Hagen Smith, who was the fifth overall pick. Also not. So you're ignoring the headliner in the crochet deal or the guy that they took fifth. You're going to Sam Antonacci or Caleb Bonnemer. Okay.
I like guys who hit.
Ahead. Make the case.
I'll take Sam Antonacci. Can I take Sam Antonacci? Is that like preposterous?
Totally. Opinion. An outrageous opinion. Like, I would take Theo Gillen before Sam Antonacci. I know. I'm not. So maybe there's some people saying I'm underrating Sam Antonacci, but now I'm zooming farther out and I'm saying this is an absurd opinion, but I love it. You have the last pick, so take it away. This is your privilege.
I'll take Sam Antonacci. Give me the guy in the big leagues that's OPSing 807, man.
Okay. Sounds good.
Cool.
He's been very good. Sam Antonacci has been a revelation. Sam Antonacci is, of course, notable because this is a fifth round pick who has played his way to the majors in under 2 years, which is... There's only a few guys not non-first round that are already in the big leagues from this draft. Peyton Tolley is one of them. Ryan Johnson, the pitcher with the Angels, Gage Jump. So Sam Antonacci is an outlier in that regard, and he deserves credit. I think he would be a first-round pick.
You don't see the ceiling. You don't see the ceiling.
Would he be, would he be in the top 10 here? No. And this is where you mentioned Caleb Bonnemer. That's someone who they got in the second or third round, who's a high school shortstop out of Michigan. He's been one of the bigger prospect breakouts this season. He's been great. And there are some other guys who are still in the minors. Theo Gillen with the Rays, who was a first-round pick, he's looked incredible. He's like a top 50 prospect type. So when you're thinking super big picture and long-term upside, you could argue to still be taking some of those guys, certainly higher than they were drafted, if not earlier than we have. Before we wrap this conversation up, I do think we need to at least acknowledge the other top 10 picks and kind of where we're at with them.
Yeah.
And then we'll take a break. So Charlie Condon, right? So Charlie Condon goes third to the Rockies. He had one of the great college seasons ever at the University of Georgia. And I think that very quickly, the concern at the time was, okay, even if you say, great, he is this incredible offensive force with this incredible raw power, he had bounced around a lot defensively in college, but really what that meant was, is he actually good at any of these positions? Because if he's not, we're talking about a right-handed first baseman. And if that's the case, you really better be hitting.
You have to be Pete Alonso.
You have to be Pete Alonso. Could Charlie Condon still be Pete Alonso? I'm going to say yes, but it's extremely unlikely at this point based on what he's shown.
I was out from the jump. I was out on draft day. For me, like, he was a guy I wouldn't have taken. I didn't love the swing. The power was incredible, but I thought the swing and the adjustability to different parts of the zone was not very good. And I was low on the defensive home. This is like, I feel good about this evaluation. I remember looking back on it. Sure. Just that was one of my, pound the table type takes, which was I just would not have taken Condon. Could he? He's going to hit a ball 500 feet in Coors Field. Like, that's going to happen. And we're all going to drop our jaws. I just don't see him as a first division first baseman moving forward.
Right. And that's what I wanted. Let me just clarify what I said about could he be Pete Alonso. I think he could have some seasons in the majors that look like a Pete Alonso season. Do I think he's going to hit a record number of home runs in his first six or seven seasons? No, I don't, the way that Pete did. He'll be in the big leagues this year at some point. He's been pretty good in AAA. But overall wise, yeah, I mean, he's obviously not at the top here. Hagen Smith at 5 is someone who was also divisive on draft day because he was a lefty throwing mostly fastball slider. His slider was just so much better than what anything that any hitters in the SEC could deal with, that his numbers were outrageous. And he's just struggled to stay healthy, struggled to throw strikes, was pretty good in AAA this season and looked like he was trending towards a promotion. Now he's on the injured list again with, I think, a shoulder issue. So he'll be a big leaguer. He'll probably strike out a bunch of guys. Is he definitely a starter? Probably not. Could be. So he'll be a useful big league pitcher, but not a top 10 pick at this stage. And then Christian Moore is a weird one because they zoomed you. This is different than Charlie Condon because you were all in on Christian Moore.
Correct me if I'm wrong. You were all in on him.
And he zoomed to the big leagues, but we didn't really know what to make of that because the Angels do that with everybody. And so far, he has yet to prove anything in the majors. He was raking in AAA this season, just got called back up. He's now bounced between second base and third base and left field. So his defensive home was always unclear. Honestly, Christian Moore versus Charlie Condon right now is an interesting discussion. I'll maybe lean slightly towards Moore, but I'm not so sure.
We struggle with this. Like, when you see players do things in person that you'll never forget, you are higher on them. And that is why when teams draft, they mix different types of opinions. And this is why having a model is helpful. I watched Christian Moore hit for the cycle in Omaha that he capped off with a line drive home run to dead center field, something that no one does in that ballpark. And I was like, that is a special hitter. I do not care where he plays defensively. The juice is real. Give him to me. And turns out facing major league pitching is much harder than it is in college. Do I think he's a bad player? No. Do I think I would take him in the top 15? No, I do not. I think that's it, Jordan. I mean, we could say Cam Smith's name. We should say Ryan Walsh.
The two more I just want to mention, Cam Smith, just because of like how ridiculous of a trajectory he's been on with the trade, with the spring training hype, with Mauricio Dubon saying he could be a 60 homer guy, playing amazing right field defense, a position he'd never played before he got into the big leagues, but can't really hit elite bat speed. He's really weird. I don't know what to make of him. And then just because, again, timely, if you haven't seen what this Braves prospect Eric Hartman has been doing, he was a 20th round pick out of a Canadian high school kid. And is now maybe like a top 50 prospect in baseball. I just want to mention Eric Hartman because like he ain't going in the 20th round again. I can promise you that. But he also still has a lot to prove because he is still in A ball. All right. This was very fun. We could talk about these guys all day, but hopefully people enjoyed that, that redraft, that look back all the way back to 2024. We're going to take a break. When we return, two sweeps from the weekend, the Tigers are alive and oh, look at those fighting fish go. We'll be right back.
Back to Baseball Barbacast. Just two sweeps over the weekend, but before we give the Tigers and the Marlins some credit, let's send Rafael Devers to timeout.
Clean up, everybody.
There is no shame in getting swept.
I never got swept.
You guys got swept.
The Fighting Fish taking all three at home over the Giants. Miami is the hottest team in the sport. More on them in a moment. In fact, maybe we would have talked about them earlier had Rafael Devers not finished game three on Sunday with a very odd temper tantrum.
All right. So the Marlins, you know, they win Friday, they win Saturday. And on Sunday, it's a close game. And Rafael Devers draws a walk, I believe, in the ninth inning.
Draws a walk in the to lead off the ninth. He's down 0-2 and he works a walk. It's a good walk. It's like not like a bad walk or an easy walk. It's like he works the walk. He earned the walk. And he gets to first base. He's feeling good. And out to run for Rafael Devers is Jonah Cox. Jonah Cox, speedy outfielder, guy who could do a lot for a ball club. Certainly faster than Rafael Devers. Here's the take. I think I'm faster than Rafael Devers. That is the thing I believe. Wow. Whether it's true or not, it's kind of irrelevant. Devers is very slow. As Jonah Cox comes out to run for Rafi Devers, Rafi says, no. He wags his finger at the dugout and waves Jonah Cox back. But because Jonah Cox was already announced as the pinch runner, he has to go in and Devers sulks back to the dugout, dodges a pat on the back from bench coach Jace Tingler, and we have more drama in San Francisco.
Well, so plenty to get to here. First of all, I do like the, you know, sometimes you'll see pitchers being like, no, nope. You stay in the dugout, Mr. Manager. I'm not coming out of this game.
And we applaud them. We usually applaud them for that.
Right. We say, which is interesting because like in this case, there are definitely situations where the reliever coming in is definitely better than the pitcher on the mound. This one is a little bit more straightforward. You can't really argue that Rafael Devers is faster than Jonah Cox, and this is a classic pinch running situation. I'm also now thinking, would we ever see this for a defensive substitution? That would also make me laugh if someone out in the outfield, like imagine Tommy Edman in the World Series when they put Andy Pajes in at the end, was like, no, I'm staying out here. I'm going to be out here for this.
I mean,
this
that's
out.
What
then Blue Jays won the World
Series.
Castellanos
did that. got him in trouble with his skipper. Like
that does happen. That's true.
But what's so bad about this in my mind, and we love Devers and we'll defend Devers probably more than we should and more than other people would, is that if he doesn't want to be pinch ran for, that can be communicated after the fact in private or not as much in public. Now, part of what makes Devers seem so petulant and juvenile is that he does still look like a baby. He has a baby face. He has big cheeks. And so that we like prescribe a level of childishness onto this adult man, which is maybe not 100% fair. But when he does something like this, it certainly does not help his cause. This is the type of thing that a player, when you are the best player on the team, can do if you are kicking ass. In fact, if Devers had a OPS that started with a 9, there is a chance that he doesn't get pinch run for under the thought process of, I don't want to take him out of the game so that if we come back, I need to have Rafael Devers up. That's not what he has been. He's been better recently, certainly, but his OPS is 735. He is not performing like the type of player that can put their foot down and insist that they not be taken out of the game. You have a lot more leeway when you are elite. And Rafael Devers, to this point this season, to this point in his Giants career, has not been elite and has not earned the ability to pull this type of stunt and not be criticized and not be chuckled at.
Let's bring in Tony Vitello into this conversation, because this specific instance, like, there's also a version of this where the Giants are 5 games over .500 and Devers is great. And this could be like almost a funny interaction as opposed to, oh my God, the Giants are a disaster. Oh my God, Rafael Devers, you know, what a baby, right? But let's bring in Tony Vitello, because obviously after this happens, they ask him, quote, "We talk every day. I'm good. I would," basically, they're asking like, "Hey, do you got to talk to Devers about this?" He says, quote, "We talk every day. I'm good. I would rather have guys like Webby where you have to rip them off the field as opposed to vice versa. Devers declined to comment." Let's get back to Devers declined to comment in a second. But let's talk about Tony V here, right?
He loves that.
His explanation.
He loves declining to comment.
He sure does. Tony here is also in a tough spot, because this is another one where I've seen people criticizing, why isn't Tony Vitello being more, why isn't he almost standing up to Devers after the fact and being like, that was ridiculous. Why is he doing that? In a way that I would guess a lot of other managers who maybe have managed in the majors for a long time would just go to the media afterwards and be like, that was ridiculous. We're going to talk to him. That looked terrible, made me look bad, bad teammate, et cetera, et cetera. There are a lot of managers that would just straight up do that. Instead, Tony tries to explain it. And he says, quote, "He was signaling over to us that he's good to run. We DH'd him the first game after the day off just because of base running, a little bit of soreness in his leg, but he's good to go. And so part of that, and then part of it too, competitively, is he wants to stay in the game." So Tony is trying to tell the public, it's all good, man. He just is a competitor. He just wants to stay in. We're good. And if this wasn't the Giants season that was happening, and if this wasn't the season that Rafael Devers was having, you could be like, okay, fine, right? I sort of understand that. Unfortunately, it is the opposite. You are having this disastrous season, whether it's Tony Vitello's fault or not. And I imagine that Tony's in a tough spot here, because he's thinking, I am not in a position, because we keep losing and because no one believes in me and because Rafael Devers probably doesn't care what I did in the SEC, to be like, you need to clean it up, dude. Like, this you are making us look bad. He keeps defaulting back to, the players are always right. I can't be the one that's trying to set the rules because I just got here. And some of that is true. And some of that is probably adding to the problem of this disconnect between Devers and the Giants, Devers and anybody, Tony Vitello and his clubhouse, whatever you, however you want to describe it. And it sucks and it's really disappointing, which brings us back to Devers. Like, he's declined comment over and over through many of these circumstances over the last year and a half, whether it was with Boston, whether it is with San Francisco. And I'm sorry, like, I'm usually not the person being like, you have to speak to the media, but it's in this season, in this context, considering everything that has happened that has led us to this point, you gotta say something. You can't, like, I'm sorry. I think you gotta say something. And maybe some people listening or you disagree with me, but that's where I'm at on that.
No, I agree with you. There are two reasons why I agree with you. One is, like, that's what the money's for. Like, yeah, is speaking to the media annoying? Yes. It's not always the easiest thing in the world. It's not the hardest thing in the world. People have much harder jobs, and he's getting paid a preposterous amount of money. And part of that is to be the face of a team, right? Is to handle that type of thing. The other side of it is, like, if I don't know what Rafael Devers is thinking, if he won't tell the public how he's feeling, then we're going to project onto the absence of an answer. And that does not benefit him, right?
Nope.
If all Rafael Devers used to say yesterday is what Tony Vitello said, even if it's BS, right? He could just say, oh, you know, I really wanted to be in there. I thought I would get up and hit again. I know it's the manager's decision. but like I'm really passionate about staying in the game. Great. That's it. But when he doesn't do that, that's the problem, right? Is that it becomes this void and there's no way to explain it. And for Devers, who does, he like really doesn't talk like at all. I just believe that if you are making that much money, part of your responsibility is to not even conduct a positive relationship with members of the media, but like is to be responsible and accountable. And I don't think that he's done that. And it bums me out, man, because I love Rafi. You know, we first met Rafi Devers when he was in, you know, high A as an 18-year-old with braces. He's a great hang. I just wish it wasn't going down this way.
Yeah.
Let's bring in one more character here. Because if you thought Rafael Devers and Tony Vitello looked the worst in the situation, well, that's fair. I think Alex Cora butting into this is the most unnecessary, unforced, weird look of all. Alex Cora, former Red Sox manager, last night tweeted, but emoji with the zipper mouth. Do we think this is about Devers?
Well, let's say that it is. What is he trying to say?
I think he's trying to say that people in the Boston media or Red Sox fans were critiquing him for being unable to handle Devers. Mm-hmm. And I think that Cora, and this is something I do genuinely believe, I think Cora did everything possible with the Devers situation that he could have done. Maybe not everything possible. Like, he should have had Devers working in at first base. Like, there are other things he could have done. I think generally Cora handled a difficult situation as like pretty well in Boston. But I don't think that people look back on the Rafael Devers Red Sox catastrophe and blame Alex Cora. And so
I mean, they might. Like, it's probably not the first thing you're might, saying.
But he's not the primary character. He's hopping into this conversation and saying, I told you so. But it's like no one asked you about this. And I just think that his willingness to troll his former players and employers is just a little bit odd. And I think that, again, who am I to tell Alex Cora how to conduct himself? I'm just a schlub behind a microphone. Just the high road is always easier. It's always easier.
And maybe he's referring to something else. Maybe Alex Cora just decided to tweet on here. And actually what he's talking about is how he tried to tell you that Uruguay was not going to beat Cape Verde. Mm. And you didn't listen. And now he has to get on Twitter and be like, but I tried to tell you that Uruguay wasn't that good. But now I say, so, yeah. But guess what? Alex Cora, if you are talking about something else and this is the only time you've tweeted in however long,
yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
Come on. Like, what do you think is going to happen?
You lose the benefit of the doubt.
So,
as if he hasn't been trolling in other instances too, right? It's not as
right,
if
right, exactly. Hasn't. Exactly.
I don't know. Exactly. I think it's interesting and entertaining and compelling to have this type of Alex Cora character that'll hop on and tweet weird stuff. But it's like, does Alex Cora tweeting this make people respect him more?
Right. I mean, I guess some people who really like Alex Cora are like, hell yeah,
it's
just like whatever he says, like, oh yeah, we miss Cora. But it's also weird. It's like you're taking shots at someone who's not even on the Red Sox anymore. That doesn't make any sense. So I agree. It's very strange. All right, let's wrap up the Giants quickly, and then we'll move to the Fightin' Fish, who are in a much better mood. The Giants, they're terrible. They're a bad baseball team. As we looked at the standings and we said, who are we burying? Who's cooked? That you're looking at it. This is the sixth time they've been swept, tied with the Royals and Tigers for most times being swept. And most notably, even more embarrassing, I would say, is that they are still the only team that has not swept anybody all season long. Again, when you think about how much winning Tony Vitello did at Tennessee, how many times He brought in even good teams, showed up to Knoxville, and just got their ass kicked for 3 days in a row. Not once through 70, whatever, 80 games have the Giants gone into a series and won all the games. Hasn't happened a single time. Is that Tony Vitello's fault? No. But the fact that he hasn't experienced that a single time is astonishing after what he dealt with or what he, you know, oversaw in college. Okay, so the Giants are terrible.
Storyline to watch there. In 2024, when they won the national championship, the Tennessee Volunteers won 60 games.
I think
that this Giants team will get to 60. Not a guarantee. Keep an eye on that.
It's true. They're on pace for like 65. But if they trade Arise and trade Chapman and trade Robbie, like, you're right. There is a path to sub 60, which would just be... Woof. Okay. All right. Let's get in a better mood. Let's talk about the
I want to move. I want to move quick through the fish here. We're going to have a little bit longer of a fish conversation on Wednesday, I believe. But we do need to tip our cap to the Marlins. 8-game home winning streak. They're 14-4 in June. The hottest team in the sport. 2 games over .500. 0 run differential, which is a good thing. Half game back of the third wild card. Otto Lopez has been incredible. But most importantly, Scotland's Tartan Army is coming to Miami. The Scots, who took over Fenway Park, the third game for the Scottish World Cup team is in Miami against Boisieu this week. And that means all of Scotland is headed down to Florida. On Monday, today, this very day, there will be like a Scotland march to Marlins Park that the fish are holding. It is going to, if we thought Boston was this like perfect melding of these two cultures, this is going to be even more compelling because of how like incongruous you would think Miami and Glasgow are. That being said, the atmosphere at Marlins Park, which is usually very empty, which is very echoey, there will be scenes unlike anything that we have seen at that ballpark, in my opinion. And if you want to make sure you can get there, Game Time app, like, good time to buy some tickets. If you live in Miami and you're like, I haven't been to a Marlins game yet this year, go today or tomorrow or Wednesday. It will be an atmosphere that you have never seen before and that you will never see again.
We've said, oh man, how great would it be to see an atmosphere like this in Marlins Park? Yeah, Scotland was not in the World Baseball Classic, right? They were not in that group with DR and Venezuela and
I don't think they were.
They weren't. So this will be a little bit different. We have seen some raucous crowds in that venue. A little bit of a different flavor. Game Time app, go get your tickets, go sit with the Tartan Army. All right, one more sweep. Before we talk about Bryce Harper and his heavy bat, the Detroit Tigers are alive. Oh my goodness. Boy, did they need this.
Wow.
Boy, did they need Huge. This. And listen, this is not a get right series against the White Sox, because the Chicago White Sox arrived in Detroit on Friday in first place in the American League Central.
Yep.
And so it was like, okay, like, Tigers, you don't just get to look at it and be like, all right, great, we can beat the White Sox. You have to earn it. And earn it, they did. Tarek Skubal pitches on Friday and he's good. He's not overwhelmingly amazing. He did allow home runs to Randall Grichuk and Junior Perez, but he threw 94 pitches.
He yells at Mike Vassell.
70 strikes. He yelled at Mike Vassell. That's true.
Yell at each other. Mike Vassell is a character we have not talked about, really.
We should.
For the White Sox. Yeah. Well, back pocket. If you're listening and you're like, who's Mike Vassell? Throw that name in your pocket.
So that was very strange. Troy Melton, the pitcher I've been excited to see finally get back on the mound for Detroit, he was very good on Saturday, although he did allow a home run to Jake's beloved redraft, Sam Antonacci. Dylan Dingler,
good player.
Homers on Saturday and on Sunday. He is, top five MVP right now. I mean, he's been absolutely unbelievable. Even on this terrible Tigers team, defense has been great. Offense has been tremendous. And the Tigers rally on Sunday, the kinds of life they have not shown late in games whatsoever this season. They score in the 8th, score in the 9th, score in the 10th. They walk it off Matt Vierling on Sunday to complete the sweep and move to 33-44. But you know what? You got to start somewhere. There are still only 7.5 games back of first, 5 back of the third wild card, although there are 5 teams ahead of him. And hey, they dropped the White Sox out of first place. Stretch
of the year. Key moment of the season. Yankees in town. Astros in town. Head to New York next weekend. Or excuse me, next week. Yankees, Astros, Yankees. I think once that dust settles, we will either say Tigers or we'll say Tigers. Tigers. Let's take a break. Tigers. Let's take a break here and do Bryce Harper cycle after that. I am having a great time doing a podcast with you, Jordan, and I hope that that energy continues.
Keep it up. We'll be right back on Baseball by the Time.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We need to talk about Bryce Harper's cycle. The most emotional that you and I get about baseball, I think, is Bryce Harper. He just means so much to two kids that grew up in DC, who were in high school when he debuted. Like, it's the whole thing, right? We are here in part because Bryce Harper made us fall in love with the sport. And over that time, from our high school lives to now we are married men, Bryce Harper has accomplished so much, and yet he had not accomplished a cycle. At no point in my life did I wake up or watch Bryce Harper and say, hey, he doesn't have the cycle. So when he was a triple shy during Philadelphia's rout over the Mets on Saturday and tried to stretch a double into a triple and reached third base safe, somehow, and thrust his arms into the sky and hollered to the heavens with joy in his heart and his lungs, I was kind of taken aback. That's Bryce Harper looking like Bryce Harper.
We have been very open about, like, the cycle is not an achievement that we have ever been particularly moved by. However, while you can roll your eyes at it, the triple shy, there is a unique feeling of when someone is a triple shy and the batted ball could be a triple. Like, that is a very, very unique,
when it goes in the gap,
sporting emotion. And so this was textbook, right? Because when you get the single last, it's like, oh, cool, okay. But because in that case, when if you hit the triple first, no one's like, cycle watch. I mean, maybe you are, but that's not how it feels. But triple shy and you hit one in the gap or you hit one in the corner, that is very fun. And then, as you mentioned, not something he's achieved before. And for me, it's just that, like, yes, this one moment where he's fired up and showing emotion is like, yep, there he is. So this is what we did not see last year, really, at any point. It also reflects in his production, which is now up to a 143 WRC plus, which is much more in line to a couple years ago than last year when he was at 131, which is still a really good player. But I will say, if we are throwing it back to our offseason discourse of, is Bryce Harper still elite? I do think that there's a big difference between 140 and 130 WRC plus, but maybe we should still be asking even more of him.
He feels like he's been more engaged, like, especially since the Phillies started piecing their season back together. The Phillies are here this week in DC. I'm going to get a better sense for this. I just get a sense from afar that Bryce's overall disposition has been more positive than it was last year. And in a way, that is part of what I think Dave Dombrowski was calling out, not just the production. Mm-hmm. The other great part of this is Bryce Harper going for a triple in this spot is a ridiculous decision. The Mets are up 11-1 in the fifth inning. Runners on first and second. He puts the ball in the backside gap in the left field. And when he hits second base, the ball is in the cutoff man's glove, right? The cutoff man throws it home to try and get Kyle Schwarber scoring. He is safe by quite a bit. But if the cutoff man just turns to third and throws it there, Bryce is out by 30 feet, 25 feet. But because he never breaks stride, they do give him a triple instead of a double with the advancement. Bryce being like, well, screw it. That's 12 to 1. Like, I don't care. And
to me, it's interesting because, right, the official scoring is he never stopped running. You know, sometimes
he was like a triple out of the box.
Throw. Sure. And sometimes if you advance on the throw, like you stop and then they throw it and then you run, that's where you get double advance on the throw. To me, this is, who's the cutoff man in this situation?
The infielder is friend of the program, Zach Short, who has bounced Zach around Short, the big leagues this season.
I'll say it to his face next time I see him.
One of my favorite people in baseball.
I'll say it to his face next time I see him. That is a misread. You should be throwing straight to third base and making Bryce Harper look silly if you are on the Mets. This is not anything anti-Bryce Harper. I think that trying to get Schwarber there is a whiff.
Zach Short is out there trying to get outs for the ball club, dude. I don't know what to tell you.
Okay, there's an out at third base. It's Bryce Harper. He's not even anywhere close yet.
Fair.
That's my take on the Bryce Harper cycle. Last Phillies thing. Actually, sorry. Two more things from this series. Kyle Schwarber has 29 home runs. Homered three times on Saturday. What? Homered again on Sunday. He's four ahead of second place Jordan Alvarez. He's got 29 homers, as I mentioned, through 77 games. Last year, when he had 56 home runs, a career high, only 23 home runs through 77 games. What I love about Schwarber this season is we thought he had maxed out the Kyle Schwarberness. We were wrong. He is now whiffing so much. He is pulling the ball in the air even more. He is like, this is he is a caricature of himself, and he's so talented and so disciplined and committed to this approach that he has 29 home runs. He's going to hit 50 again. He's one of the best hitters in baseball. That said, it is, I mean, you thought he was striking out before. You thought he was whiffing before. It's reaching a pretty comical level. Again, he's a great player. I'd love to have him on my team, but he's really I didn't think he could push it any farther towards that end of the spectrum, and he's doing it.
One of the greatest June hitters of all time, Pride Month, Schwarber, OPS up to 924 for his career. Freddie Peralta got absolutely clobbered in this series. His ERA is now up to 4.83. He allowed 10 runs on Sunday, or on Saturday,
Saturday, yeah.
Lindor is almost back. Andrew Painter to AAA. That's all we got from this series.
I do think that, like, Freddie Peralta is going to have to be a bigger conversation at some point. You did still have him at number two on your free agent rankings recently, I believe.
Yeah, that was before he's making a good, he's making a push down.
Yeah, I'm not saying, wow, Jake Mintz is an idiot, but it is like at some point where I know this is one start, but at some point we may have to reevaluate, like, what is Freddie Peralta? That is something we can talk about. All right. We have more baseball to talk about, but we're going to go fast. It's time for turbo mode.
Faster than fast, quicker than quick. I am lightning.
I feel the need for speed.
It's turbo time.
Rockies 2 out of 3 over the Pirates, who just can't get out of their own way. Two awful losses for the Buccos in Colorado. There was an unfortunate interference call at the end of Saturday's game that had Buccos fans up in arms on the internet machine. It's interference. This play was interference. Billy Cook running from second to third with the bases loaded in two outs and one run game. Grounder to Kyle Karros over at third base. Cook's the edge of his cleat touches the edge of Karros' glove. That is interference. You can't touch the runner. Excuse me, the runner cannot touch the fielder. Them's the rules. From two teams that make me frustrated to two teams that are really damn good. Braves taking 2 out of 3 over the Brewers. Really impressive showing from the Braves. We had the Ozzie Albies game on Saturday. First two opposite field home runs batting right-handed. Hit them both in the same game. One off Kyle Harrison, and then a walk-off against Aaron Ashby. Both of these were just like way down the right field line. We had Martin Perez out-dueling Jacob Mizorowski on Friday. Baseball is a delight. It is everything we could ever dream of. Should Martin Perez be in the Cy Young conversation? Who says no? Braves cannot complete the sweep as Bryce Elder had a long-awaited stinker on Sunday, allowing 8 earned runs. Braves over Brewers, is this a preview of a playoff series? Almost certainly.
The Los Angeles Dodgers might have something to say about that, as the Dodgers welcome the birds into town.
Tweet.
And one of the worst losses of the season, Baltimore on Friday. We'll spare the details of that, but Dalton Rushing does get the walk-off there. But look at those birds bouncing back. We got, and by the way, the loss on Friday was with new father number two, or two times over, Shohei Ohtani. Congratulations on another
four-time MVP, two-time father.
Exactly. Two-time father. Ohtani's like, oh yeah, another baby. So he misses Friday's game. The Orioles lose. Comes back, homers in Saturday's game. Orioles win. Orioles win on Sunday as well. I mean, best series win of the season for the Orioles. Not even close there. Maybe they can get back on track. Maybe Friday was rock bottom, and now we go for the birds. Mm. But still a long way to go to prove on that front. Let's go to the north side, where the Chicago Cubs welcomed the Toronto Blue Jays to town, and they were only able to play two games before getting rained out on Sunday. That results in a highly inconvenient rescheduling for a Thursday off day in August, which both teams will surely be dreading. The one note from this series is that Pico Armstrong homered again. He's leading all non-Otanis in Fangraphs WAR, and it's not close. He has passed Bobby Witt Jr., who is, of course, now injured. And holy crap, PCA, he's doing it.
It's a great reminder that the season is long. The season is long. We cannot give up on people in April. Mm-hmm. PCA is good at hitting. Is he great at hitting? We can give up on him later.
I was going to say, we cannot give up on them in April. We also cannot probably crown them in June, as we learned last year. So, just at least remarking that he's number one in F4, and that's not insignificant.
Probably should be an all-star. Again, Royals taking 2 out of 3 over the Cardinals. The Royals are missing everyone, which is unfortunate because this team needs their best players, and a lot of them are hurt. Mikel Garcia did come back this week. He missed a couple games, but Bobby Witt Jr. has a grade 1 MCL sprain. They should call that first grade. First grade MCL sprain just sounds funnier. Not going to go on the IL. Maybe at least has not gone on the IL yet. Still a possibility. They'll backdate it if they need to. Doesn't seem to be a huge, huge deal. This Sunday game was ridiculous with the Cardinals winning 12-10. A lot of British fans of soccer confused that Kansas City is in Missouri and not in Kansas. Astros 2 out of 3 over the Guardians. We got an Astros not selling report from Bob Nightingale, which makes sense. The Astros are just 2 out of the wild card. They're pot committed. They're 3 games over .500 since May 1st. The top 6 of this lineup is finally fully healthy and looking the way it should, with Peña, Yordan, Christian Walker, Isak Paredes, Jose Altuve, Yiner Diaz. Hunter Brown is now back as well. Still a little concerned about the depth of the starting staff, but this was a good showing for the Astros at home against a good Guardians team. Let's keep things rolling. Tough look for the American League. They did go 8-11 over the weekend to chip away at the NL's lead, but the Reds took 2 out of 3 over the Yankees in the Bronx. Cam Schlittler dominated on Friday, career high 13 Ks. Jazz hit another homer. There was, you know, Jazz got hit in the nuts. Everyone made a lot of jokes. Not wearing a cup still. I get that. Here's the thing about wearing a cup. It's uncomfortable.
Mm. Yeah.
Have you ever worn a cup?
I have, actually, not since I was 12, 11. I definitely did at some point in my little career. The point is that, and there are players that are not catchers that wear cups. And like, I don't know if everybody knows that.
Oh yeah.
But that is a thing. But Jazz is not one of them, and he's been pretty defiant saying he will not be wearing one of them. And I can't say I blame him, even after what happened.
They don't feel good. I mean, they don't feel as bad as what happens if you don't wear them, but they certainly don't feel good. Reds and Brewers are playing for the first time this season. That'll be an interesting thing to keep an eye on, as the Reds finished this weekend series really strong with great starts from Chase Burns and Andrew Abbott. You want to take the Mariners?
Boston Red Sox. Oh, we keep burying them over and over and over, and then they just say, no, wait. You know what happens, though? They leave Fenway Park and they're like, wait a minute, we're not so bad at baseball. They take 2 out of 3 over the Seattle Mariners, unable to get the sweep on Sunday, but they do get some great starts from Ranger Suarez, who's just on the Red Sox and probably like, what the hell's going on here? Connelly Early and Peyton Tolley. Mariners do manage to win on Sunday. The Rays, another moment for the American League. The Rays taking 2 out of 3 over the mighty Washington Nationals. Griffin Jacks is in the rotation now. He's been pretty good. Johnny DeLuca, 2 home runs in the same game? Or was that across multiple games? Because if Johnny DeLuca hit 2 home runs in the same game, I don't know why that wasn't leading MLB.com. Shame on them. CJ Abrams does it, 3 more home runs. He's been fantastic. Unfortunately, the Rays take this series. 3 more series. Rangers over the Padres, Twins over the D-backs, and A's and Angels split a 4-game set, including the Angels blowing an 11-4 lead on Friday. I do think there's a Twins conversation to be had at some point, but that conversation is not happening today. We are done. We did this podcast on this Monday. We are not done. Oh, we're not done.
We are not done.
Not done. Oh, boy.
Rafael Devers appears to have deleted all of his Instagram posts.
Oh, goodness.
Except for 2 from his time with the Red Sox. I do not know what his Instagram was yesterday, but his profile picture is him with the Red Sox, and he only has 2 posts, which are from 2024. So I don't know.
I feel like
that
he,
seems.
I don't.
He was
I,
on there.
How much
I feel
does
like.
He was okay. I hope so. If not, this was a silly update. But either way, all things Devers. Listen, if we're gonna have more like NBA style Instagram sleuthing nonsense, like I'm always torn on whether that's a good or a bad thing. But the Giants are just, oh my God, the Giants, it's so bleak. All right. We are done. That's it. You can email us at baseballbarbiecast@gmail.com. Big news, friends. Baseball Barbiecast will now have its own YouTube channel coming up soon. It's going to be Yahoo Sports MLB launching next month, so keep an eye out for that. We will definitely be promoting that in the weeks leading up to its launch. But for now, make sure you are liking, subscribing, wherever you are consuming this podcast. We appreciate you so very much. We also appreciate Andrew Hartz for producing this podcast. And we'll be back on Wednesday. I will be joining you bright and early from Phoenix, Arizona, waking up to do this Wednesday pod with you. Until then, thank you all for listening. Talk to you soon. Bye.